Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, February 24th, 2015, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. We're still looking for a few more members of the Crystal Soul Group for our next Starseed Crystal Quest in Arkansas, which is May 10th through the 16th, ending with Pleiadian lineup. This group is identified by having at least one of these six astrological star markings, either 25, 26, or 27 degrees of one or more of these six signs, Capricorn, Cancer, Aquarius, Leo, Taurus, or Scorpio. If you feel the call of the crystals but aren't sure if you have the required markings, just send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com with your birth info, the date, time, place, as well as your current location, and I'll be happy to take a quick look at your charts to see if you're part of this soul family and send you more details if you are, because the spots are filling fast. Our guest this evening is Dr. Artie Sixkiller-Clark, whose new book is called Sky People: Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. Dr. Clark set out on a seven-year adventure from 2003 through 2010 through Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico, collecting stories of encounters, sky gods, giants, little people, and aliens among the indigenous people. She drove more than 12,000 miles, visiting 89 archaeological sites. The result is an enthralling book with original, unique, true stories of encounters with ETs and UFOs. Her previous best-selling books include Sisters in the Blood and Encounters with Star People, Untold Stories of American Indians. Native American spiritual leaders have adopted her, Woman with Great Knowledge by the Blackfeet, the Northern Cheyenne call her Walks All Woman, and the Lakota Sioux have named her Woman Who Helps People, and her website is sixkiller.com. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to starseeds that you won't hear in the mainstream. And we'd like to thank Fiona and Claudia for hosting the switchboard this evening. We also have an online starseed community at starseedhotline.ning.com. And special thanks go to Tammy for her dedication to the forum. You can download our show podcasts on iTunes or right from our Blog Talk Radio episode page. Just look for the cloud with an arrow icon. The toll-free number for starseedhotline.com is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, don't miss out on your 10 hours of power. Find out when it happens by requesting your solar return timing. So first this evening, I'd like to introduce Anastasia with the Starseed News. Hi, Anastasia.
Good evening. Hi. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Arielle. It's great to be with you tonight. And we better get our news started. We're going to have a wonderful program tonight. This just sounds so interesting. It's just going to be a great show. Well, let's start out with our talk about the sun, as we normally do. There has been an explosion on the sun today, as a matter of fact. The Solar Dynamics Observatory recorded a spectacular eruption near the sun's southeastern limb. This comes from spaceweather.com. Now, the blast was rooted on the backside of the sun, but some of the explosion's debris fell back to the sun on the front side. They say that Earth, however, was not in the line of fire. And people in the west of North America witnessed a spectacular clusters of fireballs and meteors last night, we now know that it was the re-entry and breakup of a Chinese rocket body. Specifically, it was stage 3 of the CZ-4B rocket that launched a satellite in December. This debris of fireballs and meteors or things coming out of the sky covered a great number of states in the west half of the North American continent. So it was quite a large area, and a lot of people probably saw that. We have a report now that the sea levels along North America's northeastern coast has experienced a record rise from 2009 to 2010, and this is according to a report by his team of scientists right here in the United States. They say that from New York to Newfoundland, coastal waters rose by more than 5 inches over the two-year span, which will be published in an upcoming issue of the publication Nature Communications. They say that the extreme sea level event along the northeastern coast of North America is unprecedented during this past century. They say that statistical analysis indicates that it's one in 850 year event. So once in 850 years. They say that this extreme rise caused flooding all over the northeast coast as far south as Cape Hatteras off the coast of North Carolina, and this has been reported by phys.org. So a number of scientists and organizations are keeping their eye on that. Well, a new study out has shown that when we go out to take a nice deep breath of air, well, we're likely to have inhaled a dose of Monsanto's best-selling herbicide Roundup. This is according to the latest U.S. Geological Survey that was published in the journal Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry. Now, the chemical used in Roundup is glyphosate, and that and some other inert toxic chemicals were found in over 75% of the air and rain samples tested from the Mississippi River Valley from 1995 to 2007. 75% of air and rain contains Roundup and other bad chemicals. Well, in Italy, over 380 people have been evacuated because a massive sinkhole opened up. This happened in Naples, Italy. The residents of Naples woke up Sunday morning to this enormous sinkhole that opened up in the middle of the street. Now, officials think that the sinkhole started off as a depression in the road. They think it's probably from broken pipes, but the photographs on the internet were amazing. It was enormous, just enormous, enough to move 380 people. We still do have sinkholes occurring all over the world. I just don't report on them all the time. That's probably all we could. We could just have a sinkhole newscast and talk about that every week. Well, the USGS is trying to cope with earthquakes that are induced by fluid injection. You know, this has kind of been rumored and talked around and different things, and nobody's really openly admitted it. But now, a paper published last Thursday in the journal Science provides a case for increasing transparency and data collection to enable strategies for mitigating the effects of human-induced earthquakes caused by wastewater injection associated with oil and gas production here in the United States. Now, the paper is a result of a series of workshops led by scientists at the USGS. They collaborated with different universities, and it suggests that it's possible to reduce the hazard of induced seismicity through management of injection activities. One has to wonder about that. Our scientists seem to be so confident that everything can be managed. You know, large areas of the U.S. that used to experience few or no earthquakes have, in recent years, experienced a remarkable increase in earthquake activity, and this caused a lot of public concern as well as damage to structures. Well, now they have determined that the rise in seismic activity, especially in the central United States, is not the result of natural processes, but is the result of fracking. So there you have it. And they're trying to decide how they can do that more safely. How about just not fracking at all? Oh, no. We have an interesting thing happening in the sky. Astronomers have been puzzling over a comet that passed, and I'm quoting, insanely close, end quote, to the sun on the 19th of February. Now, at first glance, they thought it was just a small object. It wasn't much bigger than a comet boulder. And they thought it was doomed to disintegrate in the fierce heat of our solar disk.
but instead it has emerged intact and is actually brightening as it recedes away from the sun. Unofficially, this icy comet is being called SOHO 2875, but the Naval Research Lab explains that what's odd about this is that it's a non-group comet, meaning that it doesn't appear to be related to any other comet or comet family that we have on record. Strange. And inside of the statue of Buddha in Holland, Dutch scientists have discovered that Buddha, which they have scanned using modern technology, a Buddha that was dating back to the 12th century, has a mummy inside of it. Yes, indeedy.
Oh.
They have actually, they scanned the Buddha, beautiful gold Buddha, nice and big, had a mummy inside of it, and they scanned it. They took samples of the mummy inside the Buddha. They took DNA samples. They discovered scraps of paper with an ancient Chinese characters written on them, and the mummy is identified as the mummified body of the Buddhist master Lingguan. It's described as being one of a kind and consequently the only one that's available for research here in the West. A Buddha with a mummy inside.
Wow.
Well, Apple's at it again. Your next iPhone may be trackable even when it's turned off, if Apple's newest patent has anything to say about it. Now, the Cupertino tech giant has just patented a technology that would periodically exit an unpowered state and transmit location data. What does that mean? Well, you know, the old Outer Limits radio television program, many of you don't know anything about that. You're too young. But the narrator used to say, we have control of the set. We have control of your dial. Well, which was supposed to be creepy in those days. In fact, it's still creepy. What this is essentially saying is that Apple and other people can just turn your phone off, turn your phone on, even though you've turned it off, transmit location data with you having nothing to say about it. And what this means in practice is that the device would fake being turned off if it receives the wrong security code or a certain number of times, and then it would periodically transmit location data. And this would help track down, they say, stolen devices. It raises privacy concerns, of course. Now, a recent experiment by researchers at Stanford has found that Android phones can be reliably tracked by their power consumption without the user's consent. And the tracking feature may be an added security measure for future generation iDevices. They say in December of last year, the company patented a laser beam mapping technology that's currently in use by scientists and law enforcement. So they're really using this technology to really check us, see what we're doing, that's for sure. And in a similar vein, an article out by TechDirt says that smart cars are harvesting tons of information about consumers' driving habits. They say that as new driver information technology makes its way into vehicles, so does the apparent desire to harvest information about the driver's driving habits. Now, between the outside harvesting, which is something like an automatic plate reader that gathers plate and location data, as well as photographs of who's in the vehicle, there's also inside transmissions. All of that says there's very little that entities, any number of entities, unknown entities, people that we don't know, third parties, car manufacturers, anybody else they've sold this information to, as well as government entities, there's very little that they won't know about a person from accessing this information. And that's not even including what's transmitted and collected by the driver's smartphones with their installed apps. Now, this is such a concern that Senator Edward Markey has expressed alarm on the amount of data being collected and distributed to third parties and unknown parties by vehicle manufacturers. His office produced a report showing that nearly 100% of cars on the market include wireless technologies that could pose vulnerabilities to hacking or to privacy intrusions. Now, a car nowadays amounts to a four-wheel tracking device, because they're collecting and transmitting the data such as GPS location, sudden accelerations, decelerations, seatbelt usage, destinations entered into navigation systems, the last location you parked, the distance and time you traveled, and a variety of information on other driving components, some of which we don't even know about. Almost all of this is transmitted back to the manufacturer of your automobile for their own use. Now, nearly 100% of the vehicles,100% of the vehicles are reported to not have any security system to protect that data. They're not describing that security system to protect your data. And while purchasers may be allowed to opt out of certain collections of security information, no manufacturer presents this information up front. They prefer to hide it in the owner's manuals and terms of service agreements. So if you buy a car 2014 or forward, you're really going to be exposed to all types of information and data gathering from all types of entities, known and unknown. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, we have smartphones, we have smart cars, smart meters, we even want smart houses. And I just think it poses the question, are we just too dumb to be smart about our privacy? Because that appears to be what's happening.
Wow.
Well, DARPA has created a device that plugs directly into the visual cortex and alters DNA. This comes from a website on the net, and they are saying that now this technology is in crude form. It's undergoing research and development through animal testing, specifically with the neural connections of a zebrafish. Now, for the longer term, DARPA researchers, and I guess you all know that DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, they believe the gene-modifying optical technology will be able to restore vision to the blind and impaired. But according to CNET, DARPA is reportedly working on a device known as a cortical modem that plugs directly into a person's DNA. Not only does this unique device help someone overcome poor eyesight, it generates a built-in heads-up display that appears right in before their very eyes. In other words, it's an artificial reality generator that appears in front of a person's eyes. The implants create an augmented reality projection that appears like magic in your natural vision without the need for helmets or things like Google Glasses.
Wow.
And if you must preserve messages for people into the far future to read, they say that Blu-ray discs and USB sticks are no good. For real long-term storage, you want a DNA time capsule. Well, coming next, on the horizon, DNA data storage. Just 1 gram of DNA is theoretically capable of holding 455 exabytes. Enough for all the data held by Google, Facebook, and every other major tech company with room to spare. They say it's also incredibly durable. DNA has been extracted and sequenced from 700,000-year-old horse bones. But conditions, of course, as we know, have to be right for it to last. So that is what is on the future horizon. This is being reported through the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, and the scientists there are working on ways to increase DNA's longevity so that we may store data for thousands or millions of years.
Wow.
You know, that's pretty old news for us healers, because we recognize that we store a lot in our DNA, and now science is coming forward verifying and validating that. Fascinating. Well, the Canadian military is denying a UFO crash in Manitoba, Canada. Social media reports of a possible UFO sighting last night near Jackhead, Manitoba, are not true, says the Canadian Air Force. It attributes the bright light that people saw to an airplane from a training exercise. Well, people said on Twitter and Facebook the other night that they saw a bright light in the sky. It fueled speculation, as they thought it was a UFO. Now, the rumor became stronger when photos were posted of Canadian forces vehicles in the area, with some people claiming the military was there to contain a UFO crash site. And while not in this article from a major news outlet here in the United States, latest UFO sightings reports that taking pictures in the scene was strictly prohibited and the Army was issuing threats to people. witnesses apparently saw a round object being hauled across the lake and pulled out by snowmobiles and a bombardier. 8 fishermen reported the incident, but authorities did not let the media know anything about it and denied it, saying it was a plane crash. It said at least one person managed to get a photo of the craft, but unfortunately, that person has since been detained by the Canadian military. Now, if you want more information about that, you can Google and read a MUFON report of the Canadian light in the sky. Check that out. And our quote for the week. This is lovely. Gratitude unlocks the fullness of life. It turns what we have into enough and more. It turns denial into acceptance, chaos to order, confusion to clarity. It can turn a meal into a feast, a house into a home, a stranger into a friend. Gratitude makes sense of our past, brings peace for today, and creates a vision for tomorrow. By Melody Beattie.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't that beautiful? I know, Arielle, I thought of you when I found
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah.
That is a beautiful part of our manifesting and a very important part of our metaphysics. So looking forward to tonight's show. I'm just wishing all of you Starseed listeners the very best. I love you, open my heart to you, and I say, despite what's going on in this crazy old world, you are so beautiful, each and every one of you. You inspire me. You lift me up. Your radiance is lighting the way. And so from my heart to yours, peace be with you, and we will be again together next week. I'm going to turn it back to you, Arielle, for our really special guest tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Anastasia. And Lavendar, I have Artie on the switchboard. Are you ready to go?
Yes, I'm ready. I'm here.
Okay. Let me get your mic open here, Artie. All right. Artie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Artie,
and before we start, you know, I'd like to make one clarification, if I may. In the introduction, you said that I had been adopted by 3 tribes. Actually, I was adopted by individuals within those tribes and given names by spiritual leaders. So there is a difference. A tribe doesn't adopt anybody. Individuals
okay.
within tribes.
Okay, I was paraphrasing, but thank you for the clarification. Okay.
But I just wanted to make that clarification.
Okay, great.
Okay,
Lavendar.
So, Artie, it's Lavendar here, and I'm so happy that you agreed to be on our show tonight. And I'd like to start out by asking you, what really inspired you to do this research?
Well, you know, I've always had an interest in stories about star people and the stars and the cosmos. And back when I was a child, I would hear these stories. And when I came to Montana State, one of my jobs as the director of the Center for Bilingual Multicultural Education, in addition to being an assistant professor at the time, was to go out and to recruit students, Native American students, to come to Montana State and study to be teachers and principals and superintendents. And on my first trip out in the field, I met a man who had organized my meeting with the students on his reservation. And he told me about the star legends of his people. And he took me up in the mountains above his village, and he said, if we're lucky, they'll come. And I said, well, who will come? And he said, well, the ancestors, the star people. And I sat there and I listened to him, and I thought, how many other tribes have these stories? Because, you know, I had heard those stories growing up. And so as I, over the years that I worked at Montana State, and I would travel and speak at conferences and do research and recruit students, whatever I was doing, I would, if I were in a casual situation and felt comfortable, I would ask the people if they had any star stories. And I not only started collecting legends, but I started collecting encounter stories. And so that led to my first book. Actually, I've collected well over 1,000 stories now from indigenous people. So I wrote my first book, Encounters with Star People, which were stories of American Indians and Alaska Natives. And then I had, when I was a teenager, I just fell in love with this, the work of John L. Stevens and Frederick Catherwood. They were two 19th century explorers who heard rumors of these ancient cities in the jungle in Mesoamerica. And their colleagues didn't believe they existed. But Stevens and Catherwood set out in 1839 and went in search of these ancient cities. And when they returned, they made it all the way through. They stopped in Belize City, and then they made it through Honduras and Guatemala and then across the river into Palenque. And then Catherwood, they were at Palenque for 28 days. And Palenque is in a mountain, a very moist atmosphere and a lot of mosquitoes and just a very difficult working conditions for them because the site was totally overgrown. And Catherwood got malaria, and Stevens got him to Uxmal, which is in the Yucatan, in a drier climate, but he still wasn't recovering, so he brought him back home. But they wrote a book called Incidents of Travel in Central America, the Chiapas and the Yucatan, and I read that book, and I just vowed that one day I would make this trip. I would follow in their footsteps. And then I read their second book, and in 1841 they went back again. And this time they just traveled to Mexico, and they wrote Incidents of Travel in the Yucatan. And as I was collecting all these stories, and once I had retired at MSU, I thought, you know, I'm going to follow in their footsteps. I'm going to live that promise I made to myself. But along the way, I have been collecting stories about UFO encounters for 30 years. And so I decided that given the fact that so much had been written about the ancient astronaut theory and the fact that people had said that the Maya did not build those great cities, that ancient astronauts came down and built them, I decided that I was going to investigate that angle as well and, if possible, collect contemporary stories. And that's what I did. It took me quite a while to do it because I didn't have the resources or the time to stay for a year down there, which was at minimum. I think I probably spent 2 years going back and forth if I counted up all the days. But it was a journey of love, and that's why I did it. That's what motivated me.
So how many countries were involved in this research?
Well, you know, I went to Belize. At the time Stevens and Catherwood went there, the country was called British Honduras. And the Spanish and the British were fighting over that piece of land. And what eventually happened is out of British Honduras was born Belize as an English-speaking country and Honduras as a Spanish-speaking country. So the country was basically broken up. So I went to Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico.
So while you were in Belize, did you happen to go to the place where the Hedges crystal skull was found?
No, I didn't. I didn't do that. I basically was trying to follow as closely as I could to Stevens and Catherine's itinerary. But I did make several, even though they didn't stay in Belize very long. I did make several trips. One of the things I wanted to go to a community where the Garifuna language was still spoken, So I went to that town, and then I encountered two people in Belize City who told me stories, and the only other place that I, you know, I went was to this site. I heard this story about the Stone Woman of Belize, and there were rumors that some people said she came on a UFO. Other people say, well, no, she just appeared. They didn't know where she came from. So I went in search of that story and talking to an elder who said that she had such power. And this woman had been appearing since the 1600s in this village, and that she had, but she had such power that she could make you believe anything she wanted you to believe. But he said that he had figured out how she did that, because the power was in her eyes, and if you didn't look into her eyes, she couldn't control your thoughts. And he saw her come down from this UFO, and it returned the same way on a beam. And he said, others tell different stories, but it's not true. He said, my grandfather always told me that she was a star woman, and he said, now I know it's true because I saw it from my own eyes.
Did he ever say what she looked like? Did she have blonde hair and blue eyes?
No, she had long, dark hair, and she was dressed in white. And he said that, you know, she could stand almost like a statue. A lot of people, the first person who saw her was a young man, a young village man who was going hunting, and he saw this woman. He said she was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, and he threw away his weapon and ran back to the village, and everyone went out to take a look at her, but she had disappeared. Then over the years, there continued to be stories about this Stone Woman of Belize, and that's how she's spoken of today, the Stone Woman of Belize, because she has this regal appearance, apparently, that she can stand for hours and without moving. But they do say that she has the capability of walking through stone, so that she could disappear inside the temple there and just walk right through the stone. But the elder that I talked to, he was a priest. He told me that UFOs had been sighted over the village for a couple of weeks before she was seen. And he said it had gotten so that the people came a little alarmed and had started going to church and praying quite a bit, because they were concerned about what was going on and what these UFOs wanted. And then one day she appeared. And of course, he had already heard from his grandfather that she was a star woman. So he set out to see if he could prove that. But
wow.
It's not the first time that I've heard stories where an alien presence would control your mind and make you think what you want, what they want you to think.
Yes, I have encountered many ETs that have those capabilities, so I do understand. So let me ask you, Artie, when you wrote Encounters with Star People, that was your earlier book, but how does Sky People differ from that book?
Well, I think one of the things that that I wanted to show in this book is that I was dealing with a very unique indigenous population. There are only a few stories in the book that are Zapotec and Mixtec. You know, and there's 46 different stories that I tell. And of those 46, I think only two or three of them are Zapotec and Mixtec. The rest of them are Maya. So I was dealing with a relatively small population, or not a small population, because there's 15 million Maya in that region. But I was dealing with a unique population in that they were all from the same group, whereas in Encounters with Star People, I dealt with people from a variety of tribal groups in the United States. But what I wanted to do was to, here was a group of people, many of them, the majority of them didn't have access to television. Many of them didn't even have electricity. A lot of them did have cell phones, and that seemed to be something that everyone desired, was a cell phone. It seemed like it was, not only was it a kind of a status symbol, but it was also a means of keeping in touch with each other. And that's important in the Maya culture, is that family connection. But they don't have smartphones like we do. If you have one, you have one of those little ones that you buy cards for. So they didn't have access to all the newspapers and magazines and books and television shows about UFOs. And yet what I found is their stories mirrored the stories that we hear in general UFO literature. For example, I heard stories about various types of aliens, giants, blue-skin giants, reptilians, the little gray guys with the big eyes, and the tall whites. And this group had not been exposed to the kind of information we have today, you know, in, say, in the United States. They also describe different kinds of aircraft that we have heard of, circular, disc-like, tubular, or the long, I don't know what you call it, the, you know what I'm talking about, the ones that are long and round. And then the V-shaped and the a wheel-like structure. So they also had a wide range of types of vehicles. And then the experiences. There are abduction stories. There are experimental stories. There are encounters where individuals seem to want to help the people. There are generational, multi-generational stories. There are stories where someone is followed their entire life and abducted on a regular basis. So what I find so interesting about this is you've got a group of people that haven't been exposed to all this literature the way we have been, or to the History Channel, or all the other channels that have the ancient aliens and, you know, the Area 51 stories and the UFO and the UFO hunters and all those kinds of things. And yet their stories are very similar to the stories that I encountered among Native Americans.
You planned all these trips. Did you plan it by yourself? Did you have anyone going with you? Talk a little bit about your trips alone.
Well, I planned all of my trips individually. And, you know, my travel companions were my drivers and guides. I was in Mexico once with my husband and I went there on vacation with two friends of ours, but I wasn't there to collect UFO stories. Sometimes my husband would travel there, but he never went out with me out to do any research. Sometimes he would just travel and stay in Cancun or in Piste or someplace, and I would just travel by myself with the guide and drivers because he wasn't too interested in getting out in the field.
So how did you overcome the language barriers where you were?
Well, one of the things that I required of the people, before I made the trips, I made sure I had drivers and guides and interpreters. And so I was very careful in my selection of of individuals. They had to be fluent in both English and Spanish, and they had to speak the regional dialect of the Mayan language fluently. And I was also interested in somebody that had a good understanding of the history of the region, and to top it off, if they had an interest in UFOs, that was an added bonus. Because I was very upfront with them about what I was doing.
So how were you received by the locals?
Quite well. I think being indigenous helped. And also being validated by the people who accompanied me, the drivers and the interpreters, that played a major role in my acceptance into the group. And then the fact that I was willing to be one of the people, you know, I didn't sit around while the women were washing dishes and not help. And if they went for water, I went for water too. If they needed help with the cooking, I cooked too. I grew up in, you know, where we didn't have, I didn't have running water in our house, so I didn't have any problem carrying water. I washed dishes and dish pans, so I didn't have any trouble with that. So I think, you know, just people seeing that I accepted them and made no judgments about them was instead of saying, oh, these poor people, I didn't see them that way. I saw them as a thriving, loving, open communities that I was in. And instead of looking at them as an outsider, what we call in literature or in in anthropology is there's two types of researchers. There's the etic and the emic style of research. And the etic is the observer who goes in and says, looks at a sarcophagus and says, oh, this is an ancient astronaut because he's sitting there and these are the pedals of the spaceship and this is this and this is this. I go in and I know that he's sitting in the tree of life and that he's making his journey to because I've listened to the stories. I've listened to the explanation of the people, and I don't have to draw my own conclusions because the people themselves are the ones who tell the story. So instead of making my judgments from my culture and saying, you know, drawing my own perceptions, I allow the people to tell me what it is and not make those judgments.
So, was there a difference in the four countries that you visited?
Well, you know, Belize is an English-speaking country. So, obviously, there's a huge difference there. And Guatemala, Honduras, there's quite a bit of violence in those countries, especially against the indigenous people. That's the reason why you see so many of them trying to get to the United States. In Mexico, you know, there's so much tourism to these ancient, to many of the ancient sites that the people are more multicultural in a sense that they, you know, they recognize that people are from other countries and other parts of the world. And of course, Mexico is much more modern in terms of cities and services than what you find in Guatemala and Honduras. Because, you know, when I was in Honduras, they hadn't had water deliveries there for, you know, 3 weeks. And my driver, who took me there, said, you know, buy a couple cases of water and we'll take it with us because you'll find it. They'll run out of water. And sure enough, they did. So there's just that difference in services that are available although, you know, there's also pizza parlors since in Copan where I was there was a pizza parlor. So, you know, you just never know.
So,
and there's also a bilingual school there, you know.
So tell us a couple of surprising or unforgettable occurrences that happened for you.
You know, people ask me this, and every story I told was one that I really loved. The people who told it touched my heart in so many ways. But probably one that touched my heart more than anyone was a story that was told to me by an elder who... He told me that he was going to be 100 in 2 days, and he was this story took place in Honduras, and he was telling me that he had been at Copan. He had worked there for 75 years. And he said that he came to work there when he was 5 years old, when the first archaeologist came there from New York City, from the Museum of Archaeology in New York City. And he said that Spinden was his name, he said. And I looked it up, and he was the assistant curator of that museum. And he said that Spinden paid him 10 cents a day. And he... was a runner for him, he said. I would run and get water. I would run and bring lunches. I would run and do this. And he said that Spinden told him if he would learn English, he would give him 25 cents. So he said by the time he was 8 years old, he was speaking English. And he said then a couple of years later, a group from Carnegie came in, and he said they paid him 50 cents because he could speak English. And he said the other thing that they did is they told him if he found any artifacts around any place, they would be interested in buying them from him. So as the entrepreneur that he was, he went out into the mountains with his cousins and friends, and they would search for artifacts on the weekends. And this particular weekend, he and his cousin had gone into this cave, and they came across... the remains of a body, a skeleton basically, in a silver suit. And he said it was about a meter in size, which would make it about 3 feet, I think. And he said that it was dressed from its top of its head to the bottom of its feet, he said, in silver, a silver fabric, a fabric that he had never... that he had never encountered. He said that in the cave it was cold, but when they brought it out into the sunlight, it became hot. He said that I asked him to describe the suit, and he said that the covering on his head was like a tin can, like a coffee can, turned upside down. And there was a tube that came out of it and went into this pack on the front of his suit, and that the suit had, that pack had a number of different colored buttons on it. And he said beside this remains of this star man was a tablet, and it had writing on it, and they knew it wasn't Mayan writing, so they thought, you know, this must belong to this man. And he said that they had stories that the people told about the silver men who came from the stars and in flying discs that spit fire. And he said that they had always lived in the mountains. They would come and sometimes stay for months and then would go back to the stars and then would come and sometimes only stay a day or two. And he said... you know, the people had talked about seeing them. He had never seen them, but people said they saw them, and they left them alone, so the people left him alone. And so they carried this remains back to the archaeologist. And the archaeologist, when they saw it, became very excited. And he said he heard one of them say, "We're going to have to send this back to the university." And I said, "Well, did they?" And he said, "Well, I think they did, because I never saw it again." And he said, "The next day I saw a box." And he said, "I think they put him in that box and sent him back." And it's some scientist in the United States, and maybe even the government, knows about this little silver man. And he said, and ever since that day, he said, that I did this, I've regretted it. And I have never been able to forgive myself for what I did, because I gave away something that was so important. It would have been able to tell the world, show the world that life does exist in the universe beyond this planet. And I gave that chance away. And not only that, I destroyed a part of the Maya history. And he said, I'll carry this burden to my grave. And I explained to him that probably even if he hadn't given it to them, that it would have been covered up by some government someplace or some scientist, but that I understood his anguish but the fact that he had told me the story and asked me to write it, at least that would no longer be a secret.
So how many different things do you think he was able to find the artifacts? Did he ever say how many he found?
No, you know, and I that was the only one that, you know, I think that if there had been others that would have been any indication of, you know, of alien life, that he would have probably told me, because he knew what I was doing in his village. But I think, the second largest crime in that part of the world, besides drug trafficking, is the theft of the selling of ancient artifacts. You know, there are literally hundreds of ancient cities buried in that part of the world that have never been excavated. And looters will go into these ancient cities, and they will dig up something, and then they'll sell it on the black market for an enormous price. And there are collectors, wealthy collectors out there who want this stuff. And so that's the second biggest crime in that region.
So can you tell us about some more remarkable events that have happened that you've written about?
I was in a place called Koba. Koba is, it was a place that Stevens and Catherwood had heard about, but because it was so difficult to get there, they decided that they weren't going to make the trip. It was just too difficult. Many of your listeners out there may have been to Tulum in Mexico. It's right on the Caribbean Sea and just an absolutely breathtaking sight, not only because of its location, but it also depicts the descending and ascending gods. And they have one coming from the heavens and one returning to the heavens on their temple there that stands above the Caribbean Sea. And I had chosen young men who drive you around this Koba site because it, with these bicycles, they've got these little carts on bicycles because the distance is so far, and it's so hot because it is in the rainforest. And this one young man told me a story about that he lived in Koba, and that he was going home one night, and as he was walking, Kobai is surrounded by all these lakes and waters. And he said as he was going home one night, he saw a UFO descend over the lake and came very close to where he was. And he said he fell to the ground and was hiding. And he saw this UFO take a crocodile out of the water's edge. And he said they took it into the craft. And he said it just absolutely terrified him. So he goes to his house and he tells his wife and children, don't ever go outside at night. And he tells them what he just saw. And, of course, it just scares him to death. And he said that, you know, every night he's coming home after dark and he's just really worried about and very cautious about watching the skies and being careful of where he goes. And he said two nights later, he is going by the same spot and this UFO returns and drops the dead body of his crocodile into this lake and takes another. And I asked him, I said, well, could you see if it had been cut open or, you know, is there any sign of mutilation or anything? And he didn't know. All he knew is it was lying on its back and that he just wanted to get out of there. And I thought it was really interesting because we're so used to hearing stories of horses and cattle being taken. And I've heard those stories here, and now, you know, and I've also heard stories of elk, buffalo. In Alaska, I recently heard a story of polar bears and of a whale. So what I think that this animal taking these animals is far broader than what we've always thought it was. We've assumed they were interested only in cattle and horses. And yet it appears they're interested in a wide range of animals and are taking them on board and experimenting on them. So I found that to be fascinating.
That is fascinating. And, you know, I've been to Tulum and I've been to Copa, so that's a gorgeous area, and I've written about it and put it in my bank vault, and one of these days I'll be bringing those stories out that I wrote so long ago.
They're quite an interesting sight, aren't they?
Yes. I had some very, very strange... One of the strangest things that happened was when I was walking up to the pyramid there at Koba, some bees started following me, and they went above my head. They started circling around, you know, like my crown chakra, and then they started forming figure eights. They formed figure eights, and there were three forms of three eights that stayed above my head as I walked for about a mile. That was a very strange experience, and people took...
Yes.
Yeah.
And the sound system at... it's amazing at Koba, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can whisper and somebody can hear you that's a mile away.
Oh, I know. I hope that I'll be able to go back again. Let me ask you, have you thought about putting together tours and taking people to these places?
You know, I haven't. But, you know, it would be fun to do, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would really be.
And you know, it would really be
interesting. You know, carry on the work that you've done already. I think that's very important. And let me ask you, when you go to these places, did you ever have people come up to you and say, well, I know you from a past life?
You know, I never did have that happen to me.
Really?
No. When I was in Honduras, I was told I was one of them. I was Maya. So I don't know if that... meant that I was a Maya in another life, but they were convinced that I was Maya. I wasn't, you know, an American Indian. I was Maya, and you know, they were convinced of that. And so I don't know if that's what they were telling me or not. Are you there?
Oh,
Lavender, are you there?
Hit my mute button. Sorry, I was just talking along and slipped down, and my mute button was still on. All right. So, did you have any negative encounters that you've written about, like, you know, the reptilians with the red eyes and things like that?
Well, they were negative to the people. You know, the red-eyed reptilian was a story that was told to me by an elder who said that when he was a boy, he and his brother had witnessed something like a UFO. You know, they saw this light and it crashed in the jungle. So they woke up their dad and some other men from the village had heard them, and they took off in the direction of this bright light had gone down. And he said that they walked for quite a while, over an hour, and all of a sudden they came to this area where they came upon a smell that was very unfamiliar to them. And the men who were carrying lanterns held them up, and that's when they saw this red-eyed reptilian in this tree, and he was high above them, but they said he jumped down out of the tree. And they were so terrified of him because they said his skin was like a snake, and that he ran off in the direction of where they could see this light, like something was burning, and so they were too afraid to go after him, and so they returned home, but they were sure that it was a UFO.
So was there more than one type of ET that was described?
Yes, there were the tall whites. There were the, you know, there. Some of them said that the aliens they met looked like them, so it would have looked like the Maya. There were the grays and the reptilians, and then the blue skinned giants.
Did they ever talk about the Pleiadians?
No. No discussion of that whatsoever.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So, and there was more than one type of craft. You said there were like cigar shapes and triangles and
right
different shapes.
A bicycle style.
Yeah.
Bicycle tire, and a disc.
Right. So, what are the Aluxes? Or A-L-U-X-E-X,
Aluxes,
that you write about. Tell
Aluxes
me a story that you heard.
They're
about.
They're the little people. And one of the most entertaining stories I heard was I was in Cancun, and I had heard about this place called El Rey. El Rey is a place right out. It's actually, I think it's probably within the city limits of Cancun, but it's an ancient site. And Stevens and Catherwood had written about El Rey, but they didn't stop there. They sailed by it, and they could see these small structures. But because they were small, they just let them go by. And they just went on by and didn't stop because they thought it was of no significance. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to find out stories about the Aluxes living, because there had been stories that the Aluxes lived in El Rey. They were the ones who built the city. And so I went outside my hotel, and I got in a cab, and I said to the cab driver, "Do you know anybody in this city who knows anything about the Aluxes?" And he said, "Why, yes, I'll take you there." And that's exactly what he did. He took me down on the beaches of Cancun on the outskirts of the city. And there was a man who lived there on the beach, there among all the tourists and everything else, and he was kind of this camped out on the beach. And he said that he was willing to talk to me, and he said that there were, he said, when I was a small boy, he said, maybe 4 or 5, my grandfather told me that to know the Aleutians is to know the magic of the ancient Maya. And he said, and if you visit El Rey, you may encounter one, but you must be very careful, because the only way you're going to recognize them is if you are intuitive. And I said, well, can you explain? And he said, well, the Aleutians are the little people. They're capable of many disguises. And he said, much of the time they masquerade as lifeless forms. He said, but I've also seen them impersonate monkeys, snakes, lizards. He said, but the most likely they will be impersonating iguana. Well, now, if you've been to a Tulum, you know how many iguana are there. They're everywhere. And he said that that's their favorite thing to impersonate. So people walk right by them and never realize that they've seen an illusion. So he said most people are blind to such phenomena. And he said, if I were to see one in human form, what would I expect? And he said, well, they're ancient spirits. They've lived on the earth since it was formed. And he said, my grandfather said they were the first inhabitants of the planet. And when the Maya came, the Maya befriended the little people. And I said, well, are they angry or playful? And he said, well, they can be both. He said, they're like children. And he said, so they're diminutive, so their personality can be that of a child. He said, they can be happy and playful. They love playing tricks. And for most part, they're harmless. But he said, if you do something to them, they'll throw tantrums, and they can be very vindictive. And I said, well, how can I keep them from being angry? And he said, well, it's a good thing to keep them happy, because they have mystic power. And he said, I always tell my nieces and nephews, stay on their good side. Leave food for them and drinks. They love Coca-Cola and alcoholic beverages, he told me. He said, so keep that in mind when you go into the jungle. Carry some Coca-Cola and some tequila. And I said, was there a way to I could increase my chances of seeing them? And he said, well, my grandfather told me that if you're quiet and you enjoy the sights and sounds of the rainforest, the Aleutians will see you, and they may reveal themselves. And he said, there are other ways they interact with people. He said, if you're in the jungle and you're sitting quietly by yourself, the Aleutians may only appear to you in your senses. You may hear a rustling sound or a fleeting shadow. You may never see them in human form, but then again, if they perceive you as having a good heart, you may see them. He said, just keep in mind, they may reveal themselves to you as an ordinary phenomena, such as a feeling, a smell, or a sight. Just open your mind, and you'll see an Aleutian, he says. So I left him, but before I did, I said, do you think the Aleutians built the small shrines at El Rey? And he said, well, now, if I tell you that, and you write this book, and I'm in that book, that means that everybody's going to come to El Rey and look for the Aleutians. So he just laughed and never really answered me. He said, I can tell you this much. He said, at one time the Aleutians lived in great cities, but most have retreated into the rainforest. And he says, but I'm emphasizing that most. And he said, I will tell you again, listen, feel, taste, and be aware of everything around you. So I went over to El Rey, and as I was walking through, my cab driver went with me, the kiosk ticket seller went with me, and all I could think of were these dozens of iguana that were basking in the sun. And I thought, well, maybe they were the Aleutians, and they came out to greet me. So before I left the site, in shade of one of their little monuments, I left a can of Coca-Cola. So I hope I spread some harmony there and some good thoughts and feelings for the Aleutians. But it's it's in Uxmal. Have you been to Uxmal?
Yes, I've been to Uxmal. Uh-huh.
Well, you know, they say that in the Pyramid of the Magician there, you know, that was the pyramid that was supposed to have been built overnight by a dwarf, that there are dozens and dozens and dozens of small little rooms where the Aleutians lived inside that pyramid.
And now it makes me wonder if those figure eights above my head, those bees, I wonder if it was them.
Could very well be, because he said they take on many disguises.
I'd never seen or experienced anything quite like that. That's
amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you were in bee country, too.
You had such an interesting life, and this book, Sky People, I hope that people that are listening to the show tonight, that they will certainly go to your website and pick this book up, and the other one too. And you have what, three books that you offer on your website? Is that right?
Well, I don't offer them on my website. I just have them listed there, and I'm hoping to get my website expanded over the next month. What I'm trying to do is to organize stories that. I've been told the ancient stories of the star people and the little people and the giants and put those online so people can hear them and, you know, make up their own mind about what the stories signify.
So if somebody wanted to order your books, can they get them off of Amazon?
They can get them at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. In fact, I think Barnes & Noble bookstores are actually carrying the book in their stores. So... I know I've had people tell me they bought it at Barnes & Noble, but they also have it on their site. So, and it's also available in Kindle and in Barnes & Noble. I forget what their format is. But I welcome questions. You know, if anybody wants to write to me and ask me questions, you can reach me at ardy@sixkiller.com, and that's ardy@sixkiller.com. And I try to answer all my emails, and I will try to get back to you. And I don't have a staff, so it's just me. And so I read every one of them and respond myself. So I'll try to get back to you as soon as possible.
You know, when you do decide, if you ever do decide to do these tours, be sure and come back on our show and announce it, because we have a pretty large listenership, and people that are awake and would be really interested in probably joining you on these tours.
Well, I'll give that some consideration, because, one of the concerns that I have today are some of the places that I went, and I'd have to be very careful in planning it. There's a lot of danger, you know, a lot more danger than when I was there. And, you know, there's a lot more gang presence in some of the areas.
Well, Yucatan's still pretty safe, isn't it?
Yucatan is. But, you know, when you get out into areas like the Oaxacas over, you know, I was over in the Gulf of Mexico, and that's not so safe anymore, you know. In fact, it was getting that way. You know, I was stopped there by, you know, a hooded federal police, you know, with a machine gun pointed right at me, and of course they cover their faces, so nobody knows who they are, so the gangs don't go after them and murder their families, you know, and so, I mean, it's a big thing going on right now.
Well, I sure certainly want to applaud you for taking the time to do the research and to write the books, and
it was a labor of love.
Absolutely,
you know,
and to carry the light the way you've been carrying the light to all these indigenous places. I mean, that's just so thrilling. And you know, after looking at these books, this could be a mini series on television. Absolutely.
It could be, that's for sure.
I mean, if you gave this to the right screenwriter, and I mean, this could really be something that, that people would want to watch, you know,
mm-hmm.
on HBO or the places that are more prone to, you know, put out this kind of material, of which we're seeing that more and more. More and more people are getting awake and they're busting the, you know, the silent barrier about this subject matter. You know, you and I, we started quite many, many years ago doing this,
right.
But now this, it's kind of the reaping the harvest of what we have done for all these years. It's coming out now, and it's safe for us to come out and speak our truth. For many, many years, it wasn't safe. But I feel like that it is now, especially after 2012.
Still, you know, there still like somebody... is a lot of stigma that goes along with it. You know, for people still are afraid to talk about it. I found that not so much among the Maya, who they weren't concerned because nobody was going to know who they were anyway, you know, and the book was probably going to be mostly read in the United States, so they weren't concerned about that. But, you know, I found that a lot of the American Indian people that I interviewed did not want anybody to know who they were. I mean, that was just absolutely a condition in which they would speak because they didn't want to deal with some employer thinking they were crazy or being teased by friends or, you know, the stigma that goes along with it. They just didn't want to deal with it.
I totally understand. Totally understand. Well,
and so I think there's still that problem. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, if, you know, a lot of the stories, you know, absolutely, I think fate was on my side because sometimes a story would come to me and I never expected it to ever happen. You know, I was in Guatemala. My driver had suggested, he had taken me to his sister's house, and we had actually spent two nights at his sister's house. She was an English teacher, and she loved to talk to people who spoke English. And so she invited me to stay 2 days at her house, and during that time, you know, I got to know her family, and she had teenage daughters that I still keep up communication with them. And she introduced me to people that she knew had encounters. And when we left her house, she packed us a picnic lunch. And my driver said to me, he says, you know, why don't we take this long way around? So, because there's several little sites that are along the highway that have never been excavated, and perhaps we can do some exploration. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. So we pull off the side of the road to have lunch, and this man comes up to us, and he's probably in his 80s. And he tells us that he's the caretaker of this ancient site here in Guatemala that has never been excavated. And he said that originally the government had come in there, and they had built this caretaker's shack, but that they abandoned their plans to do the excavation. So the shack sat empty, and so he literally moved into the shack. And he protected that site and kept looters away from it. So he invited us to come into his little place, and he told me how at one time he had been in the United States. He went there looking for a cousin and never did find his cousin, but that he worked there until he had enough money to build a house for his mother and his brothers and sisters. And then he came back to Guatemala, and he stayed there. Well, then he proceeded to tell me that he took us into his little shack, and he said, and then on his wall he had all these American popular books like Stephen King and even Daniel Steele and some of these. And he said, oh, yes, I read those every night. He says, that keeps my English good, he says. So I got in my suitcase, and I always carry a bunch of paperbacks with me, and I gave him some paperback books, and he says, well, now I have to do something for you. I'm going to show you around the site. And so he took us around this site, and we came to this place. Now, he would say, now this is where this pyramid is, and this is where this is, and this is. But we came to a site where there was a bench, and he said, I built this bench because, he said, this is where the shining people of the Red Hand come. And in front of this bench was this facade, and it was like a partial structure. And above the entryway were these red handprints. And he said those were left by the Brothers of the Red Hand. And I said, well, who are the Brothers of the Red Hand? And he said, the Brothers of the Red Hand are those who travel throughout the universe and collect knowledge. And wherever they pass, they leave their red hand, so that others who come after them will never know, will also know that they don't need to collect any information there, that it's already been collected. And I found that a fascinating idea because, you know, you just think of, even here in the United States, you go and you see these pictographs and different kinds of things, and you, invariably you'll see that handprint. And he said that that was made by the shining people. But of the shining people, there was the Brothers of the Red Hand, and they traveled throughout the universe collecting knowledge.
Now, that here certainly would make a good miniseries, Brothers of the Red Hand. Wow.
Yeah. I know, but what a wonderful story.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, you have so many wonderful stories in this book. I really hope a lot of people decide to get it. It's called Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica by Artie Sixkiller Clark. At this time, Artie, I'd like to ask my co-host, Ariel, to come on just for a few moments. I realize that you're not going to be able to take questions tonight, and we honor that. But I'd like to have you come back later on when you have more information you want to share, or if you want to come back, because there's so many stories in this book that you could come back and do part two with us anytime.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Okay, back to you, Ariel.
Well, Artie, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your experiences with our audience. And
well, it was a pleasure, really.
Well, you are so welcome. And if people did happen to have questions, they can always go to your website and email them
right
to you. And you do take each one and respond, so that's a great way for people to contact you.
Absolutely.
Well, great. Well, we thank you so much for being with us this evening, and we'll look forward to you coming back with more stories, or if you write another book, we'll be happy to.
Oh, I've got one in progress.
You do?
Yes,
and
I do.
Along kind of the same lines with stories?
Actually, this one will again be about American Indian stories I've collected in the last 4 or 5 years.
And that is your background? I mean, were you born as part of the...
I'm Cherokee Choctaw with a sprinkling of French, English, and German.
Well, then you get the best of all worlds, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you for joining us. And thank you to our listeners for also joining us this evening. And on behalf of all of us here at Starseed Radio, thank you for being with us, and we'll be back next week. Take care, everyone, and try to stay warm. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.